Hello, and welcome to the Great Birth Rebellion podcast, where we grapple with current research to help you get the best out of your pregnancy, birth, and postpartum journey while still challenging the dominant birth culture. I'm your host, Dr. Melanie Jackson at Melanie the Midwife, and I'm joined weekly by my co-host, Bea, from Core and Floor Restore, and this is the Great Birth Rebellion. Welcome, everybody, to this week's episode of the Great Birth Rebellion. You're here with myself and Bea again for another episode. And today, we thought we'd already talked about this, but we actually haven't focused on it.
Not as a topic on its own, and it really deserves it.
I agree. 100% needs its whole own individual episode. In fact, as I was preparing, I was like, are we going to be able to fit this into one episode?
Well, let's see. Stay tuned to whether you're coming back next week or not for part two, because that can very much happen with you and I, especially with me.
It happens. But all of a sudden we just start digging and the hole gets bigger and bigger and bigger. It's not a hole. The mountain gets bigger and bigger and bigger of information, and then we got to climb it. Okay. Today we're talking about episiotomy, and this is an important topic because it's apparently the most common surgical intervention that happens to women in birth, more common than cesarean section in some countries.
Not in ours.
Not in ours. But let's talk about it. We're going to go through a lot of detail, and the reason we wanted to share it is that episiotomy happens in the moment, and you need to be prepared for what you will do if your clinician says, I'd like to give you an episiotomy.
And I think the reason it deserves its own episode, because it might happen in the moment, but it lasts forever.
Yes.
Once you've had an episiotomy, your body has experienced that. So it might be an in-the-moment action, but it lasts forever. It's a lifetime consequence on the body. So just acknowledging that some of you are here because you're pregnant, or you have a person in your life that you're supporting that is pregnant, and also acknowledging that some of you will be here because you've actually experienced episiotomy. So just a lot of love. This can be a very sensitive topic for those that have experienced. And if you don't need any love, you don't have to have any of my love.
We always want your love, Bea. All right, let's get into it. Episiotomy.
So what is it for those
Okay. So it is a cut that is made in, I don't want to say it's in your perineum, and I'll explain why later, but it's a cut that's used to extend the opening of the vagina so it's bigger, and it's done with scissors, and it can be done at what we call the midline or a mediolateral incision. So I'll explain what they are, but the idea is that under the pressure of the baby's head coming down and out of your vagina, when the baby's pushing on the perineum and it's bulging out, this is when it should be done, under the pressure of the baby's head on the perineum. So depending on where it's going to happen, a local anesthetic is injected into your tissues around your vagina on the outside. It's using a needle, which they often need to administer multiple doses of the local anesthetic. So they plunge the needle in and out multiple times in your perineum. So that's the experience you would feel, because that this is before your perineum is numbed. And they do that.
Multiple needle going into the skin, yes, is what you will feel. So multiple injections.
Yeah. And often they'll have one incision site, and they'll plunge the needle in through the incision site and then draw it out, but leave it in the same hole that it was initially plunged into, but then just move it around where they're going to cut.
They're in the hole and they're just moving the needle around. People have already turned the episode off.
Sorry, I know. Even when
I'm like, my pelvic. Just really a reminder, if this is your first episode, or you've not come to any of my work before, the pelvic floor is part of our defense mechanism. So when we feel threatened or we're at risk, aka our nervous system goes into flight, fight, fawn, freeze mode, the pelvic floor clenches. So if you're sitting right there right now and you can feel your pelvic floor is starting to like tense, that's your beautiful body doing an epic job of trying to protect you and your vital reproductive organs. That's why it's part of our defense mechanism. So, yeah, if we've lost you already, Well, you've gone. So sorry if you're still here. Big love. So yeah, that is not a multiple injection. The needle is in and it's being moved around so that the anesthetic can get to different areas. It's not just being put into one spot.
Correct. And often when they're trying to do it, the doctor will put two fingers in between your vagina and the baby's head to kind of bring out the area so that they can ensure that the needle only goes into you in your perineum and in the correct position. So there's a lot actually going on down there. The baby's head, the person's fingers, and a needle, plus potentially some fear and panic because this is a procedure that's being done. And you
were at a crucial time.
At a crucial time, you're about to have your baby. And another really vulnerable part of this is that you're on your back with your legs open.
Mm-hmm.
With probably most likely a stranger.
Yeah. And in stirrups.
In stirrups.
Yeah. Really important to highlight that it's not just something being done to your body. There's a whole environment of energy and relationships going on there too that's also going to impact how your body responds and feels in that moment and how the episiotomy feels for you. Like that is it's an incredible, sacred, intimate space. This is much more heightened than that because it's the birth of our baby. So just a lot of love. If this is bringing up a lot for you, just sending you a lot of love, pause it, take this episode as slowly as you need to. Please reach out for a one-on-one if you need to as well to really be held.
And also there can be women who really appreciated and wanted that episiotomy. I've witnessed in particular two big events that stick out in my head where women have said, give me an episiotomy. And are you certain? And you know that we've spoken about it before, and they totally happy with it. And I think that's a completely different circumstance. So not all episiotomies are going to have the side effects that we will be talking about today. Not all of them will be met with dissatisfaction. Some of them are like, yeah, I had one. It was fine. I was happy with it. It healed well. Nothing to report.
And some people go on and request them for their next births. So as always, there's no right or wrong here. I'm always coming, like I sit all day, every day with birth trauma. So I'm naturally thinking of all those big feelings, things that come. You're so right. Yeah, if you're pregnant and you've never given birth and we've just absolutely scared you with them. I mean, part of this is not about scare. It's about or fear. It's about providing you with the information so you can decide. Yeah, actually, in that situation, in that moment, that would feel right for me. And in this situation, it wouldn't. And that's really what this is about, enabling you to go, ooh, what's right for me? I always say that with intervention. We can have disappointment over it, but we're still grateful and appreciative for it. Trauma often comes when we didn't feel that it was necessary or we didn't feel heard and supported or like we had a choice. So hopefully this episode today really gives you the information so you can make a choice that's right for you. Or support whoever you're supporting in birth in that decision making, because it's often a time that we really need great advocacy for. You've got a baby in your pelvis, sitting on your perineum, lots of people around, typically if an episiotomy is going to happen, in a vulnerable position with everyone, just people standing over you when you're in a bed, automatically takes power away. It's automatically a powerless position. So I think this will be a great episode for support people to really listen to understand, if I have any time to stand up in this birth, this is one of them. This is a really important moment for me to speak up and advocate.
And although it can be, as you described, a really time where you feel powerless, if you're there and you say to the clinician, it's time for this episiotomy, I would like for you to do it now. And they do it. That can also be a position of incredible power and a point of incredible power in your birth journey. And certainly I've had that exact circumstance where the woman said, would you just do the episiotomy already, please? Like, I was like, are you sure? Let's talk about this. We've got some time to just do it. You know, she's like, oh, okay, yeah, okay. You know, so, there's such a vast experience.
You know, we're like, really? You wanted an episiotomy? And And that's, I mean, it's recognizing your own bias in that. But yeah, super powerful for a woman to say, yes, I want it. And super powerful for a woman to say, no, I don't want it. When that's the point of power, where especially like when they get heard, right? And if you're a healthcare provider listening to this, never underestimate the power that you allow that person to hold when you hear them.
And also, yeah, important, every single word that comes out of a woman's mouth when she's in this moment of pushing out her baby, if she manages to say words to you, those are the most important words you need to hear. Any word that she manages to muster is
super. In your career. They're the biggest words in your career that you need to hear. Because, you know, so often in birth debriefs, I hear women go, I was thinking all the things, but I couldn't say it. And as a person who's given birth twice, yeah, that whole brain to mouth function, it's at like, you know, like on a dial on the stovetop, it's at like, it's just past the on, it's not even at one, like the capacity to do that. And this is why you've been sent this episode as a birth support person, because you're the person you're supporting wants you to understand this. This is the point of the podcast, that they're like, listen to this bit. Listen to this bit. All right, appease. Let's get into
appeasiotomy. Okay, so we've put the local anesthetic in because they want, ideally you want to have effective pain relief before a cut is made. So I've seen this done though without local anesthetic, which is inappropriate unless the woman, obviously if she has an epidural and can't feel there anyway, but there's really always time for pain relief. This shouldn't be done without pain relief. Local anesthetic works very quickly.
There was something that you talked about. I don't know if you're going to go into it, so I just wanted to mention it, was that the episiotomy needs to cut when the baby is actually placing pressure on that pelvic floor and perineum. So can we just talk about that? And
yes, why? I'm about to talk about the different incision types, which we'll So a midline, and I mentioned this just earlier, a midline incision, there's two ways that you can cut an episiotomy, well, three actually, which, let's chat about it. So midline incision would be where they would place the scissors inside your vagina and cut directly downward towards your anus from inside your vagina, down to your anus, directly through your perineum. It's less common now, particularly in Western countries, because we've noticed that there's more chance that the practitioner could accidentally cut one that's too big and start to impact your rectal muscle, or that the episiotomy can extend and become a third or fourth degree tear. And also, if you're wondering, we haven't gone through the degrees of tear, but in episode 19 and episode 21 of the Great Birth Rebellion podcast, we talked about perineal suturing, where we talked about the different degrees and grades of tears and how they repair. And then in episode 21, we talked about the perineal bundle, where we did talk a lot about episiotomy as well. So I think that 19, 21 and this one, 72, go really nicely together as a complete package. So if you're really learning about your perineum, about tearing versus episiotomy, about sutures versus no sutures, this is a good package of episodes to listen to. So that's the midline incision. We're shying away from that, although there are a lot of countries who are still at the midline incision, particularly countries that are more developing their medical systems. Their training often lags, like they get stuck in, you know, there are some countries that are still doing birth like here in Australia we used to do in the 80s. And so sometimes you might find in some countries, depending on where you're listening, that midline incision is the common one. And this brings up a point that a lot of the work that clinicians do can be training and culture based and based on their philosophy and not so much on the evidence. So
that's even the modern maternity system, honey. That's the whole system. I mean, that's why we're doing this podcast.
Exactly. Right? It's basically the whole, it's the MO of the Great Birth Rebellion. Call out culture-based care and focus on what we actually know instead of what we think we should be doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so but that's the midline incision. It's going out of fashion. It has the increased risk of third and fourth degree tears. So then we move towards what we call a mediolateral incision, which is the preferred option now. And that's where the episiotomy is cut at a 45 degree angle from that midline. So you go to the midline and then 45 degrees. But then actually the perineal bundle, which we spoke about in episode 21, they started advocating for a 60-degree cut from the midline of the perineum because they found that with a 60-degree versus a 45, there's a less chance of the episiotomy extending to a third-degree tear, but there are problems with keeping on increasing the angle. And I couldn't find any research about this, but anatomically, the further your angle goes from the midline, the further away you are from actually cutting the perineum. Like, let's be honest, you're not at a 60-degree angle, you're not cutting the perineum anymore.
Well, you're in the vulva because you're on the labia majora.
Right. And so,
yeah, you're cutting the vulva, yeah. You're cutting the perineum.
Right. And I see that as a massive problem for a few reasons. If we look at the anatomy of the perineal body, it's actually this wedge of tissue that's profoundly different to other parts of our body. It appears to be spongy, highly vascular. Lots of your lymphatic system feeds into that. And if you look at it, it's a bundle of tissue that actually has an incredible ability to heal. So I actually talk about the perineum as a part of the body that's designed to tear and repair. That part of the body was made knowing that a baby may come through and that it needs to be able to either come out of the way if it needs to, but also heal itself back together. And so when you start talking about further angles away from the perineum and cutting, I think we can't expect the same level of recovery, healing.
Well, you've moved away from biology, right? Because we don't typically see tears in that degree.
Not at all.
Angle. That's not what the body would do. And so anytime you move away from what the body would do biologically, you move further away from healing being efficient.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm encouraging people to think about is as practitioners, you know, we've been taught, ooh, not that midline because we don't want to cause the side effect of a third or fourth degree tear by this episiotomy extending. But then you've got to ask, well, what have we done now then by increasing it to a 60-degree angle or even a 45-degree angle is we've started to impact anatomy that should not normally be impacted during birth. And that includes major body muscles that would not normally tear there. Because if you have a tear, then it's less likely to interrupt major muscle bodies. But also the internal anatomy of your cervix sits around that point. And so there are studies that talk about women having sexual dysfunction and a change in orgasm intensity and nerve sensation and attachment to the cervix as a result of having had an episiotomy. So,
well, there was a study in 2021 that was published that looked at I did so well at saying this word right for so long. Cadavers. I just hadn't said it in a while. That looked at cadavers. So for those that don't know what that is, people that have passed away and donate their bodies to science. And what they found was that the erectile tissue of the clitoris, because the clitoris is made up of erectile tissue, was cut into with these episiotomies. So not the midline, but the side. And so why that happens, firstly, we only discovered the true size and shape of the clitoris in 2005, so 19 years ago. And what we understand now is that clitoris extends and comes down the labia. So just a lot of love if you're hearing this for the first time. It was an incredible study.
We've got it in the resource folder, the study.
Awesome. Yeah, right. And so, yeah, now what you've got is a flow-on effect of what this procedure now has on the body.
Yeah, well, that's right. And if you tore, it would be path of least resistance. Your body would tear around the clitoris and around major structures. So that study, Garner et al. Is the one, did the cadaver studies. I think they had 47 cadavers and they did 52 incisions from memory. And what they showed is that midline and mediolateral episiotomy incisions each pose unique risks to the perineal anatomy, and there's no incision site that doesn't endanger structure. And so for now, you as a woman and potentially a clinician, I feel like we almost have a responsibility to share with women that we could do a variety of different positional cuts. Here are the risks, unique risks of each location. Which risk are you most comfortable to take? Because there might be women who would be willing to risk an extension to a third or fourth degree tear in order to avoid that the risk that come with a mediolateral at a 45 or 60 degree angle for an episiotomy. And so now that we know that each incision site has its unique risks, we have to share that with women, and women need to choose for themselves which risks they would be happy to take and which risks they're not willing to take. That's not for us as a clinician to decide.
But acknowledging that people can feel really overwhelmed by this too, because there is uncertainty, and then when people are asked to make decisions, for some people, not all, but for some, that responsibility can feel very big because of how they will then treat themselves based on what happens. Yeah, it's a part, if you're really providing evidence-based information for the people you care for to make an informed decision, then they need all the information. And this is the really tricky thing around consent, right? Because how much information do you provide? When do you provide it? What do people need to know? And so, yeah, if we've got this research that's like, actually, these cuts into different areas are going to have different flow-on effects, that's part of the information people need to receive.
And if you're really keen to fully understand that Ghana study, the cadaver one, if you're on the podcast mailing list, every week we send out an email which has the resources for each individual podcast episode. There's a whole back catalogue as well. So get on the mailing list at melaniethemidwife.com and then you can read these studies. But what needs to happen really is antenatal education around episiotomies. You can't give all this information in the moment of an episiotomy, which is really the whole motivation for this episode and probably why your midwife or doctor or birth worker has sent you to this episode, is so that you can get all the details.
Yeah, shout out to those sending people to our episodes. We really appreciate you.
And the women do too. So we get a lot of messages saying, my doula sent me this, or my midwife said I should listen, and I'm so grateful they did. This is the best thing you can do for your clients, is to send them to our podcast.
I had a woman the other day message me and say, I asked, the doctor said all this stuff that wasn't true. And so then I said, have you listened to The Great Birth Rebellion? And the doctor said, yes, she listened. She said, well, you can't have listened very well because you're saying the complete opposite. And I was like, oh.
Like, definitely making waves. If we know anything about this podcast, we know it's making waves. But also I've heard from a lot of midwives and birth workers that we're making their lives a lot easier too, because we're doing a lot of the educating of some of their clients and they're so grateful. So it's a mutual relationship.
For some.
For some. But not everybody likes us.
Yeah. Okay. So
how many women? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm just saying, you've covered the definition, you've covered the angles, you've covered how they occur. Are we going into the under the pressure of the babes yet? Because I'm passionate about that one.
Well, yes. I mean, this is the idea of an appropriate or not an appropriate episiotomy, which we're going to talk about the reasons why you might get an episiotomy. So we'll talk about the pressure of the baby's head then, because there's definitely a kind of a criteria for when it's okay to cut and when you probably should wait.
100%. And it really impacts people's experience with episiotomy. So cool. What's next on the agenda, Mel?
What's next? So how many women get an episiotomy? Why are we so passionate about this?
Why is this a podcast episode?
Why is it a podcast episode? Well, we've done podcast episodes on things that have far less percentage chance of happening to you. So now it's episiotomy's turn. So we collect stats on this. It's really easy to collect stats on episiotomy because it's part of every hospital's data collection process. And the Women's and Babies Report reports on it explicitly. So they've got long-term documentation of how many women get an episiotomy. So the latest Women and Babies Report says 25% of women giving birth in Australia get an episiotomy. That's 1 in 4. And know, though, that it varies wildly from country to country. So if you're not in Australia, you know, some places have a 5% episiotomy rate. Some places are creeping up past 60%. Some countries, if you're having a vaginal birth, that's it, routine episiotomy. And I didn't mention the research into routine episiotomy or not, but Cochrane and the World Health Organization and all of the places are basically in agreement that routine episiotomy has to stop. So if you're in a country that still does routine episiotomy, then they're way behind. Or if you're a clinician who does
routine. Just be kind. There's no evidence for it anymore.
Yes.
Is the thing. So even if you're
careful. There was never evidence for routine.
No, but it was something, I mean, well, it's like CTGs.
There was never
any evidence for CTGs.
Yet here we are. Everybody gets one.
Yeah, and that's what happened with episiotomy. So there was a time where routine episiotomies were very much a thing, and they still may be with your care provider, right? That is something to be aware of. Our rate in Australia may be 24%, but your care provider's rate may be 80%. But yes, there was never any evidence for it, and very much across the board internationally. So routine episiotomy would be they would just do one for the sake of it. So now the evidence, we have the evidence and the support to say there is certain criteria that needs to be met in order to
happen. And let's remember too that really the origins for becoming routine were during the era where they did twilight sleep.
Yes.
Where women were heavily sedated and they labored heavily sedated, and almost every woman had episiotomy and forceps in order to give birth to her baby. And so it's a throwback to that practice. It's really dark. And
where most of us within the intergenerational trauma, knowing that intergenerational trauma spans 3 generations, most of us, that was our grandparents. Some of us would be great grandparents, but it's wild.
Yeah. And because it varies so wildly from practitioner to practitioner and country to country, I think if you don't know what the stats are, specifically ask about your hospital, the one that you're going to, or your clinician, and have this conversation antenatally, just so you know where you sit on that, you know, per chance percentage. Just kind of what are the chances? If you're in a hospital that has a 5% episiotomy rate, you might go in there feeling a bit more relaxed about the possibility of getting an unnecessary episiotomy. Whereas if you go to a hospital with an 80% episiotomy rate, then you know where your battle's going to lie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And specifically here in Australia, the rates of episiotomy, they've been increasing, and studies have shown that at the introduction of the perineal bundle in 2018, it could have had something to do with it, but in fairness, the rate was already going up before the bundle was introduced. But we do have some research studies that show a pre- and post-implementation stat that the perineal bundle that was designed really was, the intention was to reduce third and fourth degree tears. But the perineal bundle has managed to increase the episiotomy rate, so in the post-implementation studies. And unfortunately, without creating a change in severe perineal trauma rates. And it also managed to increase second-degree tears for women who've had babies before. So in summary, the perineal bundle did not decrease serious perineal traumas. It did increase episiotomy rates. It didn't change second-degree tear for primips, but it did increase them for multips. So that research was covered by the post-implementation study by Nigel Lee, who we had on the podcast in episode 21 to talk about the perineal bundle. So it's with the introduction of the bundle, I think what they're assuming is with the post-implementation research that they're doing is that if the bundle isn't scrapped, you're probably more, the likelihood of episiotomies is going to go up. So that's where we're sitting at the moment. So why do they do episiotomies? So we just spoke about routine episiotomies being a thing of the past. So we're not going to revisit that. So let's see. Why else would they offer you a episiotomy? And I've got to say, personally, if I'm declaring all my biases, I sit in the camp of an episiotomy is either an emergency procedure that's done with the express intention of getting the baby out faster because it's in danger, or it can also be done in a non-emergency situation, but in that situation there's lots of time. So in the situations where I've seen it happen personally, where I've either been in the room or been the person doing it, there's been lots and lots of time. And we'll talk about those reasons as we go. But the first reason that people might give them to you, and this is really, really based on clinicians' preference, is if they think you might tear. So some clinicians believe that women don't want to tear and that an episiotomy would be better because the cut is straighter, it's easier for them to repair. We've got research that shows actually perineal tears repair much better than episiotomy cuts, but still the clinician's preference and bias will potentially override this. So if they look at your perineum and they go, ooh, I think that's going to tear, tears aren't good, therefore we'll give cut, that's based on the clinician's preference, not the woman's.
And a lot of this can often be based on the size of the perineum. I've heard that so often.
We're going to talk about that.
Oh, my goodness.
We're going to talk about perineal size.
Okay, good. I'll shut up then.
I'm glad you bring it up. You know what? The sign of an intelligent person is that they can predict where the conversation's going and they know the right questions to ask. So this is just a testament to your intelligence.
Thanks, Mel.
You're welcome. So, but I'm going to have a rant now. I don't often get to rant. I'm having a rant. All right.
Their bias in this, or are we keeping in line with the non-biased approach to our research?
I am going to combine what I know from research to present an educated rant.
Ooh. Give it to me.
All right, okay, here we go. Soapbox. So can we please stop trying to save the perineum? We know there's been all these studies of how can we protect the perineum, how can we prevent tears, how can we do this, how can we do that? Can we stop elevating ourselves to a level where we believe we have some kind of control over what a woman's body tissues, how they will behave in the process of birth? We've actually got research on this. I'm not that making this stuff up. We know that our involvement in this part of birth is minimal, unless we're actually intervening, in which case we are having an impact. But if we do nothing, what we know from research is women are actually better off or there's absolutely no change. So we did the hands-on, hands-off, hands-poised studies, which all showed regardless of whether you just let the baby come without putting your hands on the baby or the woman, or whether or not you protect the perineum, I'm putting in inverted commas around that, hands-on, hands-off, makes no difference to tear rates. And actually, women are better off if we let them get into whatever position they want to. We let them push however it is that they feel they want to. Keep your hands and tools away. So actually, I think in this regard, the perineum is not the problem. I think we are. And I want to ask the question is, do we need to reduce perineal trauma? Like, why are we so scared of it? And I get it, women who have had the 3-4% of women who've had a third or fourth degree tear are screaming down at the podcast going, but I had a third or fourth degree tear. What we've learnt about third and fourth degree tears is that short of stop of not doing midline episiotomies, the clinician's involvement in that, some were going to happen regardless of if there was a clinician there or not. There's very little intervention that we've managed to do short of the warm pack trial showed a reduction in third or fourth degree tears by putting a warm perineal pack at the time of crowning. But there's been very little interventions that we as clinicians have been able to offer in order to impact that percentage of women who are going to get third or fourth degree tears?
I think, well, okay. I love what you said, the perineum is not the problem, we are. I think that quote will be re-quoted numerous times. So something to really understand here is a lot of key performance indicators that are linked with insurance of the hospital, third and fourth degree tears, come under that often. And so it's something that people have to report on. So anytime in a system where you create something that needs to be reported on, you automatically put the behavior paradigm around that. And so people will start to judge. They judge themselves and they judge others. So for those listening to this who don't really understand what we're talking about, there is definitely a cultural belief that a practitioner can influence what happens to the perineum. And so if a care provider is caring for you and you end up with a third or fourth degree tear, what can happen after that are consequences for that care provider, where they might have to present a case, there's a case study, and it's looked into. And so what happens here is that whole someone's going to get into trouble, right? And so when you have that in a system, you naturally have people that feel scared and then start to blame. So there is definitely, sometimes it's very evident, sometimes it's underlying, a belief system that if someone you were caring for had a third degree tear, you've stuffed up. Right. So that's 100% there. And I really hear what you're saying is actually the evidence is showing us that that isn't true. And yes, we can look at the evidence for that, but this is very cultural. So that is a big, you have to understand that when you look at this topic and why some care providers are really quite passionate with decreasing what they believe is your risk of a third or fourth degree tear. Secondly, when we understand that the pelvic floor muscle is part of our defense mechanism, that statement you made is super powerful, because often I believe the body is tearing because of the positions it's put in, the pressure it's under, and the environment that it's in, right? And so often women are forced or encouraged or told they have to push in a position that actually causes the pelvic floor to contract rather than lengthen. So the pelvic floor does not push your baby out. The pelvic floor lengthens and gets the hell out of the way in order for your baby to come through. So if that muscle is tight and you are trying to allow it to lengthen and then it's forced to lengthen or forced to stretch because the baby comes through and pushes past it. So if you've got a pelvic floor that is contracted, either through fear, because there's someone standing at it going, if you don't get your baby out in the next push, I'm going to cut you, right? Which is what people are told over and over again in the birth space. They're threatened in those moments of giving birth. Or there's fear because you're laying on your back with your legs up in stirrups and your vulva opened for six people who you've never met before to see, right? Naturally, the pelvic floor is going to contract in any of those environments. Then you've got someone standing there with scissors, right? So that environment does massively impact what the pelvic floor is able to do, its capacity in that time. So yeah, 100% I see where you're at and I agree. And also I think we do need to see our role and the effect that we can have on tears based on how that person's body is feeling because of what is happening in the room and how trying to work with someone's nervous system in the moment may actually decrease tears. But I sit with you. And our message is where we both sit. Our philosophy is not very culturally accepted, but actually embracing the tearing as your body doing what it needed to do in the moment. Whether that's necessary or not is where I probably hold my passion, because I think a lot of tearing happens because of what we're doing.
Well, that's what I mean. When I say that it's not the perineum, it's us. It's us putting women in positions that increase their risk of tearing. It's us contributing to women's fear and heightened anxiety during the birth. It's us thinking that our involvement in that part of the birth is going to actually be of benefit, where I think we're causing more drama by imposing ourselves in that space because we're frightened of tearing.
And the fear around tearing actually can cause tearing or cause episiotomy because the fear of the practitioner has of tearing.
And we know that clinicians impact and the environment impacts upon tearing rates because we can see a clear difference between the perineal condition after birth for women who birth in hospital. And we've done studies that compare it to what happens if you have a continuity of care midwife and then if you have it at home. So it keeps reducing. And man, I wish we knew what the perineal status was of women who free birth. Like that would be super interesting information to know if there's a massive difference. And they would say, well, of course there is, because there's no clinician, and clinicians are often seen as part of problems with birth. But we can see that the further away that you move from hospital and the closer you get to having a relational care model where you know your care provider, that reduces perineal trauma. But the reason you might get a cut is because of your clinician's fear that you might tear and their own personal feelings about tearing. So then if you express to your clinician, actually, I would prefer to tear. And this was a situation that I had with a client of mine that we were at home and she was trying to get her baby out and it just wasn't moving past the perineum. There was a lot of head on view for a long time. And she said, I think it's time to go to hospital. And I said, I would agree with you. Let's do that. And we went in and they decided that the baby needed to be born using a vacuum, which the woman was absolutely on board with. She's like, do it. Yes, absolutely. That's what I want. And then the obstetrician said to her, I'm going to need to cut an episiotomy. She said, yes to the vacuum, absolutely no, do not give me an episiotomy. And she was so strong and capable in that moment and I was so impressed. And then the obstetrician looked at me and said, but I need to cut her because she might have a third degree tear. I said, she knows that. We've spoken about it. And she just said no. And then she sort of went ahead with the vacuum, and as she was performing the vacuum extraction, said to the woman again, I need to give you an episiotomy. And the woman said, don't. And then she went to reach for the scissors. And I said to the obstetrician, she said, no, you can't cut one. She said, but she's going to tear. I said, she knows she's okay with that. So that was a really clear discrepancy in philosophy on what we're willing to accept for perineal tears.
What you've got there is an obstetrician who's fearful. Yeah. And I really feel for care providers in this, because what is playing out for them is their good girl or good boy, and they don't want to cause harm. And in their opinion, the tear is the harm. And just like in the moment, it's not a time to be educated about episiotomy. In the moment for the doctor or the midwife, it's not a time to shift cultural beliefs. It's actually really tricky. No one's going to shift their cultural belief in that kind of moment, which is why, you know, I love that, you know, doctors are listening to this and midwives are listening to this, because this is what will enable you to reflect on your practice and go, okay, what is my belief system on tearing? What is my belief system on episiotomy? What is important, though, is what you believe and what the person you're caring for believes can be different. And our role as healthcare providers is, yes, to provide information, but to also respect the person in our care's belief systems. It's not about convincing them. It's not about convincing them that our belief system is right. It's about respecting their belief system. And that can be really challenging. That's going to challenge huge internal belief systems as well as cultural belief systems.
Yeah, I have nothing to add to what you said. That's exactly right. And there is research, there is study on this. If you're worried, if you are thinking, gosh, I really need to work on my perception of this, and if you're orientated to the research, there is a research study and a paper that we've put in the resource folder by Perrin, done in 2023, who showed that actually this idea of giving an episiotomy in case a woman might tear isn't really grounded in research, because episiotomies are only protective for primips, women having their first baby, who are having a vacuum or forceps birth. They haven't been able to show that giving an episiotomy would have a positive impact on any other situations of trauma. So, you know, if you're trying to really shift your mindset on it and you need it to be scientific, there is research around that to help you. So another reason that people, and this kind of really feeds into that previous discussion we had, is if you had a previous third or fourth degree tear, some clinicians believe that an episiotomy can help prevent a repeat one. But that feeds into our discussion we just had as well. Some clinicians, again, probably ones who haven't updated their training so much or are part of a hospital cultural system that they use this, sometimes a previous episiotomy, what they believe would warrant a repeat one. That's, again, not part of current evidence.
Yeah, can we just highlight that? Because I think a lot of people would come to this episode just for that bit of information. So many women who've had previous episiotomies are really scared that, A, they're going to need to have another one, or, B, that they're going to tear on that episiotomy line. So, yeah, there isn't the evidence that you need one again, and it's totally dependent on all the factors. So a big thing that I would say is work with your episiotomy, do some scar massage, debrief your birth, and ensure that their environment that is set up is one that will support your body to lengthen and open and feel safe.
That speaks to the discussion we had earlier in the podcast about the anatomy of it all, is that your body doesn't actually want to tear along the location of your episiotomy. The most likely place it will tear is downwards towards your anus along that perineal area. And so, yeah, this idea that if you've had an episiotomy before, you need to have another one, it's not founded. And also it depends on the reason for the episiotomy. So, and we'll talk about this later down in this list, but some women's pelvic floor just will not release and give. And there's a big muscular band that won't come away, that won't move over the baby's head. And it becomes obvious over time in that labor and birth that maybe it's time to get this baby out. And it's often, I mean, in my circumstance, it's the women who are like, what can you do? What can we do about this? Because we're doing everything. The baby's not coming out. So sometimes you might look at that circumstance and wonder if it's going to repeat itself like that. And so do I need another episiotomy? But I don't think there should be a plan to repeat the episiotomy. It's okay to wait in the moment and see what happens and have that thought process of, if that happens again, do I want an episiotomy? Do I want to try longer? You know, where's the nuance in that decision-making? But I don't think anyone should say to you, you've had an episiotomy before, therefore I will be giving you one again. Right. So the next reason that, and this is something that your clinician might also not talk to you about, if you've gotten into the situation or if you're in the situation where you need to have forceps or vacuum birth, where somebody actually assists your baby out, most clinicians, and I think this is changing, but most clinicians, as part of that package of care of using forceps or vacuum, will also do an episiotomy. They don't always tell you that, though. They talk to you about the process of the forceps and vacuum birth, but they might not always mention, oh, by the way, I will also be cutting an episiotomy. They assume that the woman maybe knows that because they're so used to doing forceps and vacuums that they go, yeah, of course. I mean, we assume everyone knows this information, but most women don't realize that that's also going to happen. What I want to reach out to clinicians in particular about today, and maybe women in regards to this, but it'd be a real challenge to talk to your clinician about this, but to clinicians, if you're listening, there has been research. It's a bit older research, but I think it's worth looking at because some newer recent studies have kind of brought this research out as a way of reigniting the discussion. But there was a study by Jeffrey Ecker and crew in 1997, which questioned the need for an episiotomy for operative birth, so for vacuum or forceps. And I've personally seen some very skilled clinicians performing vacuum and forceps really gently, much more in line with kind of trying their best to mimic the physiology of the birth with angles and speed and, you know, the pace of it.
It's beautiful. You stand back sometimes, you're like, that was beautiful.
Yes, beautiful is a word.
They do it like it's a beautiful birth where there's just a synergy between the baby, the person giving birth, and the doctor doing this procedure. And it's, you can feel it. The energy is just there. It really connected intuitive practitioners, doctors do this with just so much grace and gentleness. And you're like, that was beautiful. And they don't need to cut.
Right. And I think a well done vacuum and forcep, where the clinician is so tapped into what the woman's body is physiologically doing and just only adds the element that's needed for the birth to happen. It's poetic. And as you described it, like, I've watched vacuum and forcep births for my own clients where very rarely they need to occur, where things haven't happened at home and we move in and that's the decision. And it was done in the, like, with the least amount of impact and resistance. Yeah, and like just enough input to give the little oomph that we needed. And it's
feeling
just
in your body, like even me describing it, it's like it feels calm.
Yeah,
it's synergy. That's what it is. It is somebody who is intuitively doing paid work. They're not thinking about it. They're feeling the birth. They're observing the baby and the body, and they're working together as one unit. So they've come in with the respect of the birth and the baby and the person who's giving birth, and then they know that their role is to assist. The difference is when they come in and take over and they see that they're in charge of the birth and their need is to pull this baby out as opposed to work with the body and the baby.
There's a sense of calm about it. The ones where they really feel like they need to frantically extract a baby who's not in bad condition, I've seen those frantic extractions where the clinician has obviously put it completely on themselves to be able to get this baby out, and it's almost as if the woman is just a vessel. Whereas when there's a sense of calm and consideration and they're actually looking at the woman and going, right, she's having a contraction, they're kind of intuitively tapping into the power of that contraction and understanding how much they need to add externally in order to make this happen, and just concentrating and tapping in. And yeah, it's poetic. It's exactly how this intervention should be used.
You know, it's about self-management.
Yeah.
Anything else. But yeah, just honoring those people who do work like that. And just for those people listening, if you're not like that, that's okay. And perhaps that's on your professional development, is I want to be able to be like that. That sounds beautiful. I want to be able to offer people in my care that. And if you're listening to this as someone who's not a healthcare provider, just perhaps tapping in and going, if I know my healthcare provider, do I feel like they would be somebody like that?
Yeah. And that's what this study kind of started to question. So they did their research between 1984, which is when I was born, and 1994, so a 10-year period. And there were 2,041 operative births and that met the inclusion criteria for this kind of this study. There was 976 vacuum births and 1,065 forceps. And they had actually, they looked back on their stats actually, instead of actually putting a intervention in. They noticed that the use of episiotomy decreased in these circumstances from 93.4% of clinicians were doing episiotomies, and through some kind of cultural change, only 35.7%, that's the use of episiotomy declined. So there was a massive decline. And then what they did is they looked at, was there a correlating increase in the rate of third or fourth degree tears? So even with the decrease in the use of episiotomy in these times, they said that the change was not associated with a change in the rate of third degree tears. So it was 26.5% had a third degree tear with vacuum and forceps if they used an episiotomy, and 27% had a third degree tear without the use of episiotomy. So although So that rate was relatively unchanged, but there was a decrease in the rate of fourth degree tears from 12.2% if you had an episiotomy to 5.4% if you didn't. So that was quite a significant decrease. What they also noticed is that the rate of second degree tears or first or second degree tears increased from 16.1% where they were doing episiotomies to 40%. So there was an increase in second degree tears, but if you listen back to the suturing versus not suturing episode, you'll see that that's probably a better situation than using the episiotomies. You're probably better off with a second degree tear than episiotomy. Personally, that's my standpoint. But in this situation where you stop doing routine episiotomies with forceps or vacuums, you also increase the number of women who are left with intact perineums. So it wasn't massive, but 2.7% of women had an intact perineum. So that, and then recently there was this, a Canadian professor, two professors wrote to the Canadian Medical Association Journal and they published the letter. And this was 2020. And they called for the routine use of episiotomy during operative births, that's forceps or vacuum, to not be encouraged. And they gave a discussion as to why. So I think this opens the door for the clinicians to reevaluate their approach to vacuum and forceps birth and ask themselves, does an episiotomy really need to be done during this? Or is it just a leftover practice from when this practice of forceps and vacuum was introduced, and you know, you introduce a whole package of care around that? Is that just how you've been trained and so that's why you do it? Or is there an actual clinical need? And I feel like there is some research which could defend a practice of selective episiotomy during vacuum or forceps.
Well, I mean, that's what we're seeing in our practice. And that's what I'm seeing when people come to birth debriefs. Some people are being told, yeah, I don't need to do one. That's fine. Sometimes it doesn't even come up. The vacuum or the forceps or both happen. There's no discussion of episiotomy. And then other places, other care providers, and it can be different care providers in the same place as well. And it will say, no, it's necessary. It has to happen. I can't do one without it. So, yeah, I think it would be great to see some beautiful new research on it.
Well, and even just clinicians considering that there could be something different and exploring that. I'm not suggesting you need to change your practice tomorrow, but be open to the possibility that this particular element might not be necessary. Right, next reasons why you might be offered an episiotomy is very rarely, I've never seen this, but people talk about what's called a buttonhole tear. We've seen it where actually the tear doesn't come from the vagina downwards. It actually starts to tear like a buttonhole and the opening to the vagina is actually intact. So this is a reason
why. I saw it as a new grad and it's one of the episiotomies that I was like, I can actually see why we did that.
Yeah. So this can be a reason.
I can't believe you haven't seen it.
No, I haven't seen it.
I've only seen it once in all the births I've attended and it's so clear. It's so evident. It was wild. I was like, that is what they talk about.
Yeah, the buttonhole. And I mean, yeah, I'm a home birth midwife. You probably have seen higher volumes of birth, whereas I'm always the person involved in every single birth rather than having like this high volume.
Yeah, I've done six births in one shift before.
Yeah, see, I would have at most on a very big push would be six in a fortnight, you know. So, yeah.
So for those that don't know what it is, it does. It looks like, you know, if you had a button-up shirt and you were to pull the shirt open and the buttons go pop, 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 that's what it looks like.
Yeah. So here's a few things I've put next to them. Nope, 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 nope. Okay, so the next four are four things that I personally don't believe you need to have an episiotomy for, but your practitioner might believe it. So management of a shoulder dystocia, episiotomy used to be part of the process of that. We had a shoulder dystocia episode, so go back to that if you want details. There is a process called manual rotation of the baby where the clinician can actually put their hand on the baby's head and rotate it if it's in a posterior position. And sometimes they will argue that they need to cut an episiotomy for this. I've put a nope next to that. B's just, agreeing with me on the.
I love that you didn't say what I was actually doing. I'm making gestures, but yeah, I'm in agreement with the nope. Yeah.
What I do know is I don't believe that episiotomy is required for this if you're having manual rotation. If they think that it's taking too long for your baby to move past your perineum and that there's a delay in the birth of the baby, if your baby is well, so they've checked fetal heart rates and the baby's actually well, please, you don't need to speed this process up.
This is for birth in general. Mm-hmm. Birth is never about time. It's about well-being. Mm-hmm. Nothing in your birth should happen because of time. That is a blanket across it all. As your baby's being born, it does not need to be. The time limits came in because of coach pushing and how bad it is for our bodies. So avoiding that in the first place is key. But well-being should be what we base all our decisions on in health, not because you've reached a time limit.
If they say it's taking a long time, we can just cut this episiotomy, your baby come out, don't take the carrot. It's not a reason, not a clinical reason. You might want your baby out faster and that might be what you accept, but it's your baby's not in danger at that point.
It's not an evidence-based reason.
No, but women can make choices not based on evidence. That's fine. But clinicians have to either do what the woman wants or use evidence. But women can do whatever they want. If you want your baby out and you think it's taking too long, give me an episiotomy. I mean, it's not always going to work. All right, the next nope that I had was a suspected big baby. So some people go, ooh, we think your baby's really big, so we're going to cut an episiotomy. That's a big nope on the research. All right, this one, we're coming into some yes-nos options. So I spoke just briefly about this tight muscular perineal band. This is the only time that I've done an episiotomy at home. It was with the very express consent of the woman. She had been pushing for a long, long time. Their baby's head was on view for quite a while. It was either the episiotomy or transfer for an episiotomy, probably. There was just such a tight muscular band that wasn't allowing the perineum to come over the baby's head. And, you know, we had a lot of time to discuss it because the baby was well. So,
yeah, that's the other one I've seen too. You just like, it's not moving.
No.
Like you look at it and you're like, this baby is not actually going to come out. Like,
for hours. Like, I'm talking hours.
Yeah.
A woman in physiological labor at home who is well, who's moving, who's not, hasn't done any of the things that kind of the interventions that would hold a baby back from coming. So that's the one time we have done it. And we did it we decided we'd call an ambulance for that one. Mm-hmm. And we said, look, we don't normally do episiotomies at home. This is the first one we'd ever done. I've been a private midwife in a home setting for 16 years. And we said, if you want an episiotomy at home, we'd like to do it with an ambulance here, because if it doesn't work and it's something else that's holding the baby back, you then put yourself in a bit of a time-sensitive situation.
Yeah, that's time does matter then.
Yeah. So we're like, we don't want to cut this episiotomy and if it doesn't work, end up in a situation where now we have to manage the consequences of that episiotomy without having a transfer plan. So we called the ambulance first, who came, they waited outside. We did what we wanted to do. We waited for the baby and the placenta. It was all fine and off they went and we repaired it at home. So, you know, that could be a reason, but again, this was hours of discussion and thinking and talking. So this wasn't
an emergency. Everybody was well.
Because everyone was well. If the baby was unwell, we would have offered that option much, much sooner.
Yeah. Well, you would have offered it when the baby became unwell.
Correct. The baby wasn't unwell, so we had time. So that brings me to the one that I've got yes for is fetal distress.
Hmm.
the only reason. When I was a student, we were taught this should be the only reason why you
do it.
This
is what Cochrane was saying years and years ago. The only reason you do one, I remember talking about this in the antenatal classes. It's like it is a very good tool in a very small percentage of births when you really need it, like cesarean, like instrumental. All of these things can be incredibly valuable if needed. I think what we talk about and what we're trying to educate for is all the situations where it happens and it's not.
Yeah, and I remember as a student really being told like 1-2% of situations would warrant an episiotomy for fetal distress. And what we mean is that you're pushing out your baby. And the very only thing, and this is where we're going to talk about where the baby should be when you do an episiotomy, okay? So let's say you've got a baby who you feel, yes, is in distress and we need to get the baby out quickly and we've got tools where we could do that and get the baby out through the vagina. Is for an episiotomy to be appropriate and to fulfill the criteria for a necessary episiotomy is where the baby's head is so far down that it's through the pelvis, past the pubic bone, and it's fully crowning and is putting maximal pressure on the perineum. And the only thing holding the baby back from being born is that the perineum's there and needs to take some time to move away from the top of the baby's head. So the only
thing often where we see those tight bands, right? Like the perineum is actually really struggling to stretch. And this is not dependent on the size of your perineum at all. It's dependent on a whole lot of things like elasticity, stress, the pelvic floor muscles. It's a body issue at this point.
Yeah. And so, you know, in those situations, if you do an episiotomy and the baby's born, as it was at the episiotomy I was just talking about, we did the episiotomy. We knew it was an appropriate and good, well-timed episiotomy because after the episiotomy, the baby came. It became evident that the only thing that was holding that baby back was the perineal muscle band. And so this is where it's appropriate. You know, as a clinician, if you've done an inappropriate episiotomy, is if you cut it and the baby doesn't come in the next contraction or the following one after that.
And it bleeds because it's not actually stretched and it's full of blood supply and it's thick. And these are the ones that really struggle to heal as well. And so you're cutting into an area that should be completely thinned out and stretched and really easy to cut. And it's like there's this tight tension, you release it, baby comes. But instead they're being cut before even instruments are put on sometimes. And so you've got this incredibly vascular space and it bleeds. And so then people have postpartum hemorrhages because a highly vascular area has been cut at a time where it shouldn't have been cut. And you've now actually cut into more of the space. And so there's a hell of a lot more healing that needs to happen and a lot more damage that can happen. Yeah. So if you're the advocate in this birth, please know the only time that it needs to be cut or can be cut is when that perineum is fully stretched. So it means it looks really thin. You can see the baby's head is right behind it. Baby's head is stretching that perineum out. So the skin between the vagina and the anus, it's stretched. It doesn't look thick and squishy with a bit of a baby's head somewhere in the vagina. That head is there. You can see it. You can see the hair if your baby's got hair and the whole perineum is stretched. Only then, please.
It's bulbing out. Like it's like you've stretched a condom over the baby's head. Like you can see how like it's wearing the perineum like a beanie.
Yeah.
Then you know, is it appropriate time to do an episiotomy? If there's not that stretch and there's this thick, you know, when they cut an episiotomy where it's too thick, it looks like really hard work for the clinician.
Oh, and it typically doesn't look nice to watch because it's like, it looks like it's hacked into.
It shouldn't hack. It should be a single snip. It should be clean, quick. It should not be like that. So having said that, I do know that if they're anticipating that they need to do an episiotomy, they might give you the local anesthetic sooner before the stretch. But Yeah, this is the appropriate timing. You've had an inappropriately timed episiotomy if the perineum's not tight over the baby's head, and it's been inappropriate if the episiotomy doesn't result in the baby's birth, then that's a marker that it was too soon. So you can adjust your practice for next time. Okay, the next reason that you might get an episiotomy is racism. Racism. B's like, what, racism?
No, I know where you're going. I'm like, okay, she's gone there and it needs to go. It does need to go there. 100% it needs to go there.
She's going everywhere today. She's going to racism. She's going to go to consent. We've got a bit more to share, actually. This is a big episode. But
you could do it. We could probably split it for you. Who knows? You might be listening to us the next week right now. But it's big. It's really important.
So racism. There is some research on this. The problem is there's not enough. I feel like there's not enough research that looks at migrant, ethnic or different races, what happens to them when they enter into a Western system. So we do have some, and there is some great research. Again, it's in the resource folder, so I'm not going to go through all the nitty-gritties. But when I talk about racism, so I want to clarify, I'm not you person, you clinician who's listening, I'm not calling you racist. What I'm saying is that sometimes, well, we know that the Western maternity care system has a standard. So there's, you know, when you're comparing things to being normal or abnormal, unfortunately, our Western maternity care system is basing their normal usually off white Westerners. And so anything that deviates from this white Western way of behaving becomes a deviation. It's the abnormal part. The problem is we haven't allowed for the fact that everybody's body is different, and Black and Asian bodies and all different races, their bodies, we're made differently. And so when I talk about racism, this is the belief that because a woman's body is not Western or white, or that her perineum doesn't work or look like a Western and white perineum, that it's not doing its job right and that we need to help it along. And so what we haven't done is we haven't taken steps to fully understand how different bodies of different races and ethnicities and from different locations, what's their normal level of functioning? What can we expect as their level of normal? Because, you know, and we hear this particularly in reference to Asian women, is they'll talk about their perineums being rigid and harder and shorter and not as stretchy. And this can be a decision-making point for the clinician to sort of go, well, you're an Asian woman, your body's behaving in a way that's different to what I'm used to from white Western women, and therefore I need to intervene so that your body acts more like the white Western expectation that I have of your body. And so that's what I talk about is in terms of racism, is that we're using the benchmark of white Western body behaviors and applying that to everybody else, expecting them to achieve that standard and perform at that standard. And so you might have gotten an episiotomy simply because of the inbuilt expectation of your clinician. And this is certainly research. So Hannah Dahlen did a research paper, and Asian women were far, like almost twice as likely to receive an episiotomy as white Western women in the same facility. And I'd say that's not because their bodies are malfunctioning. I think it's because we don't properly understand what their bodies normally do in birth, because we, as a racist maternity care system, we don't care. We just think it should perform in the way that we've come to expect. And the other thing is there's also an attachment, if you're a shorter person in stature, that there's some connection between the length of your perineum. That's also not true.
And the size of your pelvis.
Yes, I know. I mean, I'm only just 5 foot, and I had no tears, and I had two vaginally born babies. Like, I know that's a case of one, but I'm just saying it's not an evidence-based thing. So this just could be a reason why. We're still on the list of why you might get one, and it could have nothing to do with you and everything to do with the preconceptions of your clinician. So I've got two more things to cover.
Do you reckon we should do it as two parts? We've been going for a long time.
I know. I've got women's experience of episiotomy. So we're going to talk about consent, complications, side effects, repair and healing.
Why don't we finish it and do it as another one?
I think we need to, because I've still got at least half an hour of stuff to talk about myself, and that doesn't include whatever you've got to add.
Yeah, so.
Part one. This is part one.
Right.
Let's do part two of episiotomy next week, and we will be talking about issues of consent and how to navigate that and the ethics of that, women's experience of episiotomy, including that of consent, repair, healing, complications and side effects. We also are going to talk about how to recover healthily from an episiotomy and, importantly, how to keep yourself safe from an episiotomy and only be the recipient of one where you believe it's absolutely clinically indicated. So there's heaps more to discuss.
Or you want one.
Or you want one.
Yeah.
So we will do that.
I called it right at the start. There's going to be two parts. You waited, you're here, you made it to the end. Well done. Now you have to make it to next week. We hope you have a brilliant week. Next week, if you're listening to this in real life, if you're listening to it in the future, then you don't have to wait. You can just go to the next episode and hear us then.
Exactly.
See you next episode.
See you in the next episode of The Great Birth Rebellion.
Yoo! Yeah, is that all right? Okay.
It has to happen. I mean, honestly, I've got half an hour more stuff to talk about.
And yeah, it'll be huge. I can't
possibly have an episode that big. So, okay. Bye. I love you. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening with us today. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcast platform and join our mailing list at melaniethemidwife.com. Mel sends out weekly emails with access to all the evidence we use in this podcast. You can find out more about Mel at melaniethemidwife.com and find out more about me, Thee, at corumfloor.com.au. We can't wait to bring you next week's episode of The Great Birth Rebellion.
Yeah! Yeah! All right.